During the 20th century, the world met demand for resources despite the fact that the global population quadrupled during that time and global GDP increased 20 times. Commodity prices actually fell. But we may now be entering a new era. According to a new report, Resource Revolution, Meeting the World's Energy, Materials, Food and Water Needs. The report is the result of a collaboration between the McKinsey Global Institute, or MGI, and McKinsey Sustainability and Resource Productivity Practice, or SRP. The report takes a comprehensive and integrated look at the resources challenge facing the global economy. It explores how surging demand for natural resources can be met over the next 20 years, even as 3 billion people join the middle class. It also looks at the increasingly tight linkages between resources, which mean that shocks can easily pass from one commodity to another. The research also considers how to combat climate change in this new context and what it would take to achieve universal access to resources. I'm Janet Bush, senior editor at the McKinsey Global Institute, and joining me today to discuss the findings of the research are Richard Dobbs, a director of MGI, and Jeremy Oppenheim, a director of SRP. Welcome to the podcast. So, Richard, let me start with you. In the past, it was the market that delivered the solution when there was a gap between supply and demand for resources, and often actually through technological innovation. So what is different about today, if anything?
During the 20th century, demand went up by a factor of 20 for resources. The market was able to innovate and add supply at enough of a rate that despite this 20-fold increase in demand, prices actually fell. In real terms, prices fell by almost 1% a year, so over the century, almost halving in price. Now, we see that the challenge going forward is going to be much harder than the 20-fold increase we saw in the last century. In fact, we've already seen the impact of that. In the last 10 years, since the turn of millennium, the commodity prices have increased by around a factor of two. So the halving that we saw all the way through the 20th century has already been offset by the growth in demand we're seeing in emerging markets. The next 20 years is going to be a lot harder than the last century for five principal reasons. First of all, we're going to see the global number of middle-class consumers increasing by 3 billion. Currently, there are about 1.8 billion. And these new middle-class consumers, many of whom are going to be in Asia, are going to want to have access to resources in the same way as the existing middle-class consumers. They're going to want to have a car. They're going to want to eat more meat. They're going to want to have foreign holidays. As we think about that happens, that's going to result in an unprecedented step change increase in demand. Secondly, while this demand is increasing, we're also going to see that sources of supply and extracting them are becoming increasingly challenging and expensive. And so we're going to see a squeeze in the cost of supply. And thirdly, that squeeze in the cost of supply is going to become more expensive too and more difficult to do because of the impact of the environment. The fourth reason that it's going to be challenging is that resources are going to become increasingly linked. Historically, when one resource price went up, another resource price didn't go up. There was very little correlation. But what we currently have is that we have a much greater correlation between resource prices. So a shock in one resource flows through to other parts, and you get a correlated shock, which obviously results in a much bigger shock in total. And the final reason that we think the next 20 years is going to be harder is that there is a growing concern that a billion people don't have access to basic resources such as energy, food and water.
So if the world doesn't do anything to counter these factors that are all hitting us at the same time, what would the implications of inaction be?
We face a risk that we enter a period of very high resource prices and very high resource price volatility. In fact, you could say that we've already entered that period, with the exception of energy prices in the 70s during the oil price shocks. Volatility of resources is at a 100-year high at the moment, and prices are at a 100-year high. And high resource prices is the equivalent of an extra tax on households, meaning they have less ability to consume other products, resulting in potentially fewer jobs in the other industries. They have to pay more of their household income on food and on energy and water. They have less money to spend elsewhere, resulting in potentially jobs being squeezed out in other sectors. And this happens particularly particularly for the poorer households. Over half of their disposable income is spent on resources. The second reason we should worry about it is that the uncertainty that higher volatility in resource prices causes means that companies and individuals cut back on investment. And there's one thing that we really need at the moment for the global economy is investment, because investment's going to create jobs. And there's a third reason why we should particularly worry about it, is that governments spend quite a lot on resources, and particularly around the subsidies. And as resource prices go up, government deficits widen at a time, obviously, where global government deficits are a problem already. If we enter a period where resources currently get even more expensive, the over $1 trillion a year that governments spend on subsidizing obviously gets much, much larger. And the final reason that we should be concerned is that it could result in a degree of destabilization between countries. The good news is that there is enough technology already discovered. The key question is whether we are able to implement this fast enough that we end up with a soft landing of gradually declining resource prices, or whether we're going to be too slow at doing this, that we enter a period of very high volatile prices, very high prices, and that provides a shock. The risk is that we could end a period, a 20-year period, of high and rising resource prices and volatility, and we could have the knock-on effect from those on both global growth, employment, the environment, and social welfare.
So, Jeremy, turning to you, what would it take to meet today's resource challenge?
Janet, we need to take a broad approach that includes expanding supply and at the same time engineering a step change in resource productivity. The scale and breadth of the resource challenge is one that means there is no silver bullet, there is no single solution. But the very good news is that there is a lot of existing technology out there that creates potential for us to meet the resource challenge successfully. It is our view that we have underplayed the resource productivity card, and the reason we have underplayed it is that resource prices fell over that century and took the pressure off managers in the private sector and policymakers in the public sector to drive the resource productivity agenda. They're going to have to take a disciplined, really strategic approach to it going forward. And what we've done is pulled together a view of the technologies and the investments that are required to drive the resource productivity agenda across 150 different potential opportunities over the next 20 years. The beauty of what we have now done is to take all of the major resource systems, energy, water, land, and steel as a proxy for the material sector, and built an integrated understanding of how they all fit together and which of the resource productivity opportunities policymakers and business leaders ought to focus on first, because they're the biggest and most valuable and highest impact.
Jeremy, the report makes it clear that even if the world were to seize all the available opportunities to expand supply and boost productivity, this wouldn't be enough to combat climate change or in fact, to provide universal access to resources, a big issue nowadays. So what more would need to be done?
So let me tackle the climate change point first. If we pull all the resource productivity levers and grow supply in the way that's described, we move the world halfway towards the emissions pathway that would be consistent with roughly a 2 degrees global warming world. There are two steps that we would focus on and are identified in the report. The first of them is that one would boost very significantly the share of zero carbon power in the energy mix. We estimate that increase in the cost of the energy system to decarbonize it would be in the order of about $200 billion a year. The other thing that we'd need to do is to drive changes in land use. And what that really means is driving up agricultural productivity and driving down the rate of deforestation. It's somewhere in the order of $50 to $100 billion a year to achieve the second stage of the decarbonization of the 2-degree agenda. So when you add it all together, it would cost in the order of $300 billion a year to get onto a 2-degree pathway. That is less than 75% of what the world currently chooses to spend on fossil fuel subsidies. So it's not an unimaginable number. It's fair to say that it's different people spending the money on the fossil fuel subsidies from those that would need to spend the money either on land use or on the lower carbon power supply. But these are numbers that we spend on a range of resource systems even today. What that $300 billion increase in the capital requirements does not take into account is the benefits that one will get through increased agricultural productivity, which could be substantial. It does not take into account the fact that the approach to driving renewable power into the energy system could lead to an even more accelerated improvement in the cost and yield performance of those technologies. And it also does not take into account the adaptation benefit. We reduce the risk of needing to make very significant investments in adaptation that would allow our economies and our social systems to survive.
So on this question of universal access to resources, how have you chosen to look at that issue?
Our view is that we only solve the resource challenge of the world if we do it in a way that makes these resources available to everybody. In the work that the Advisory Group on Energy and Climate Change conducted last year, they, along with many other experts, have estimated that in the order of 1.5 billion people still lack access to modern energy services. And the lack of access to those modern energy services means that it is impossible to achieve many of the other Millennium Development Goals. It is not possible to achieve the goals on education, on access to clean water, on health, in the absence of some reasonable access to electricity. So what we've done is we've modeled out what it would cost to achieve that access over the next 20 years. And our estimates, again mirroring those of the advisory group that the Secretary General set up last year, are that it will cost in the order of $50 billion a year. And the exciting news in the energy access space is that we may be on the cusp of this transformation, because the renewable energy technologies, just like the mobile phone, are grid independent.
But Jeremy, you sound enormously positive about what is obviously a huge agenda. Supply, productivity, the extra action that needs to be taken on climate change, universal access. But there must be difficulties ahead, surely.
There are three things that have stood in the way. The first is that the way we price resources rarely reflects their scarcity. And the reason I say that is the volume of subsidies. We estimate up to $1 trillion across all the different resource systems. So we have underpriced resources. We have certainly underpriced the environmental costs associated with the extraction and use of those resources. And we fail to take the action to improve resource productivity that we need. The second deep challenge in all of this is that we need to mobilize a huge amount of capital. And mobilizing that capital will have to come largely from the private sector. And private sector capital has many choices. And so it's essential that the opportunities in the resource space, whether on supply or on productivity or on decarbonization, meet investor return expectations. And then the last thing we need to do in terms of addressing this resource challenge is to build the institutions and the information needed to strengthen overall system resilience. And that is in part about having a much deeper understanding of where there really are resource risks. Where are the real kind of hot spots in terms of scarcity? Where do we need to take preemptive action? There is a risk over the next 20 years that if the world has high and volatile resource prices, that poor people, whether they live in cities or they live in the countryside, will be hugely hit.
Turning back to you, Richard, this agenda that Jeremy's been discussing sounds very, very broad and extremely expensive. So how attainable is it in terms of the cost?
Well, investment is going to have to rise. We think that investment in growing supply and driving productivity will need to grow said that the total investment into resources is going to be a little over $1 trillion a year, more than we've had in history. The good news is that there's a substantial benefit. Even if we just take the benefit of the productivity initiatives on their own, not taking into account the investment in additional supply, we think that those are worth nearly $3 trillion a year at current prices. So the annual saving to society of the resources saved is $2.9 trillion at current prices. And if we take into account broader social benefits from saving subsidies and saving carbon, that rises to another $3.7 trillion.
So, Richard, what do companies need to do to respond to this obviously very challenging new context?
We think as we go into this new resource world, companies are going to have to put more managerial attention behind resources. And there are three aspects of the business they need to think through. First of all, their own productivity on resources. How efficient are they at using resources? Could they find ways of being more effective on it? Do they have the right incentives to be able to do that? For instance, one company gave an example about air conditioning units cleaning. The person who buys the equipment to clean and the cleaning fluids for air conditioning is measured on the cost of the cleaning fluids, not the efficiency of the air conditioning units. So companies need to take a more holistic view of driving how effective and efficient they are in using resources. The second area the companies need to do is that for many businesses, the resource revolution will be a business opportunity. If they are selling turbines or compressors or piping, there's going to be a huge need for investment. Companies need to understand what the additional $1 trillion of investment is going to mean in terms of the business opportunity and make sure that they're aligned to seize the opportunities from that. And the third area companies need to worry around is risk management. Are they ready for a spike in oil resource prices? Are they able to adjust and reflect that? To go after resource productivity is going to require companies to take a much more holistic view and to think about all of their incentives.
Well, Richard and Jeremy, it sounds like a fascinating report. Thank you very much indeed for taking part in this podcast.